task today is to look at the history and development of the offices in the church. And of course, the church began when? That's not a trick question. When did the church begin? No. Began in the garden. Adam and Eve were the first two members of the church. And when you see the church developing in the Old Covenant, we see gradually a change occurring, because as was obvious in the garden, the church was essentially found in the family. And that's partly why there was such a great emphasis on the family in the Old Covenant, because this really was quite central to the church. Fathers were, in a sense, the prophets, priests, and kings of the little congregations that over which they presided. But gradually, we see an elaboration of structure and offices within the church. And preeminently, we see that in the establishment of prophets, spoke from God, of priests who offered sacrifices to appease the wrath of God, and elders. Remember, Moses had elders chosen and appointed. And you see that elaboration then in the Old Testament. We're going to move very quickly now into the New Testament, because there we see the same kind of structure. We see prophets giving way to the disciples or apostles. We see the elders being replicated. We see elders in the Ephesian church, elders mentioned in various of the epistles. And we see deacons who are the equivalent of the priests. But since there are no sacrifices to be offered anymore after the final sacrifice of Christ, the deacons serve as the priests did, but they serve in a different way. They serve the poor, they serve the needy of various kinds, widows and orphans, and so on. So, in the New Testament, we see a continuation of the three basic offices within the church. You get into the early church, we see that functioning, but unfortunately, towards the end of the early church and into the Middle Ages, under the impetus of the Pope in Rome, you see an elaboration of a hierarchical system within the church. And so you not only have deacons, but you increasingly don't have elders in congregations. You don't have just ministers, in a sense, taking the place of the apostles and the prophets. But you have what are gradually called priests, and then you have bishops, and you have cardinals, and you have popes, and everything gets very structured and top-heavy as you go on. So that's the situation in which the Protestant Reformation comes into being. And basically, what happens in the Reformation is you have a flattening of that structure of offices. Of course, there's no pope, there are no cardinals. In certain churches, there are bishops. For instance, in the Anglican Church in England, set up by King Henry VIII, or in the Lutheran Church, you have bishops. Even in some of the Reformed churches, you have bishops. There are bishops in the Reformed Church of Hungary to this day. But in most cases, bishops are not appointed from the top down. They are elected from the bottom up. And so they are less objectionable from that standpoint. But generally in the Reformed tradition, there are three offices recognized: the minister, the elder, and the deacon. The minister is responsible to work in the word and prayer in particular. The elders are to rule, so they're sometimes called ruling elders. And the deacons then take care of the poor and the needy of various kinds. In the Reformed Presbyterian Church, we come very much out of the Westminster Assembly period in the mid-17th century. The Assembly, in its various documents, certainly holds to the three-office view of elder, of minister, elder, and deacon. Although there were some, including Calvin earlier, who believed that there was, in fact, a fourth office in the church called a doctor or a teacher. And those were conceived as those who would be particularly gifted in teaching theology. And you can see something of that emphasis in theological education today, where, for instance, the 15 professors I had at Westminster Seminary, between them had about 20 years of pastoral experience. Most of them had never been pastors. They were simply academics who were teaching us how to become pastors, even though, you know, you would never go to medical school and be taught by somebody who's not a doc, wasn't a practicing doctor earlier. You wouldn't go to law school and be taught by someone who hadn't been a practicing lawyer. Well, you have pastors being taught by those who were, had never been practicing pastors. But even though there is that, there are those who hold to a four-office view in the Reformed tradition, that never came to be accepted in the Presbyterian tradition represented by the Westminster Assembly as being the standard, at least officially. Another interesting thing about the Westminster Assembly is that in its discussion of deacons, they took a vote and narrowly approved the idea of having women deacons. But as generally happened in the Assembly, they took several votes before they were happy with the ultimate wording of each document or part of the document. And they took another vote, and women deacons were narrowly defeated. So there are no women deacons in the Westminster directory form of church government. We're going to come back to that, but I wanted to mention that in passing. Well, the Assembly ultimately failed in its stated goal of bringing uniformity to the churches, the state churches in England, Scotland, and Ireland, the so-called Three Kingdoms. We don't have to get bogged down on why that happened, but of course, by the end of the century, England, the Three Kingdoms are exhausted after a series of wars and persecutions. The king is driven off of his throne by his own daughter and her husband, whose husband was actually the king's nephew, son of one of his sisters. Must have made it all the worse for the poor guy who got everything he deserved. But, humanly speaking, we can understand that he'd be a little distraught at this change of events. The Reformed Presbyterian Church came out of those who believed that it was important to maintain a separate testimony for Christ's kingship, mediatorial kingship over the church and the nation, because the king, the new king and queen, because they ruled jointly, William and Mary, University of William and Mary fame, William and Mary ruled not simply the nation, but they ruled the three national churches of England, Scotland, and Ireland. They chose the bishops, in the case of Scotland, which was Presbyterian, the General Assembly could not meet without their representative being present, and they could not make any decisions that the king disagreed with. Our forefathers said, no, this is unacceptable. The church is independent from the civil magistrate, Christ exercises his rule directly upon the church without any civil magistrate being involved in it. He rules, of course, through offices. We still maintain that. And we maintain the three offices. Well, in theory, we retained three offices because in practice, we had no ministers. 1690, the three remaining covenanter ministers all went into the state church. One of them later confessed that it was the biggest mistake he'd ever made, but that's what he did. Groups of Reformed Presbyterians, which were called societies, met for what was called fellowship meetings for a period of 16 years before they had any ministers at all. So count yourselves blessed in Harrisonburg that at least on an occasional basis there are ministers among you. But what happened is essentially families would get together in homes. They would read the scriptures. They would discuss sort of a Bible study format. They would sing the Psalms and they would pray. Well into the 19th century, even after ministers started to be raised up, this was the pattern in Reformed Presbyterian churches. You had very strong local groups meeting, and then gradually they would gather together into a congregation and have pastors. Well, in 1706, finally John Macmillan joined us from the Church of Scotland, he labored for 37 years without a ministerial colleague. Although for many of those years he had a licentiate of the Church of Scotland who associated with the Reformed Presbyterians, as they were starting to be called. Yet he was never ordained because they believed that it was necessary to have two ministers to lay hands on anyone, that no one minister could ordain someone. And in 1743, a minister from the what's called the secession churches, which had seceded in the previous decade from the Church of Scotland, the established Church of Scotland, joined them, and they immediately organized a presbytery, and we sort of never looked back. Seems to us that in extraordinary circumstances they could have gone ahead and laid hands on this young man who served for many years and actually died before the presbytery was formed, but that's what they did. Well, so the church developed in Scotland, in Ireland, through emigration in North America, both in Canada and the United States. Congregations were formed out of these different society meetings. The structure was similar with one exception to what was envisioned in the Westminster standards. Generally, Reformed Presbyterian churches had no deacons. There were those, and not just in Reformed Presbyterian circles, who have argued that the deacon was a temporary office during the time of the New Testament, because the apostles were overwhelmed. Of course, that's in Acts 6. That's the original impetus to having deacons. However, we see lists of qualifications for deacons, and it seems a little more permanent than that argument suggests. But we did not have deacons, and in the various RP denominations, there tended to be simply local committees. They had different names for them, different countries, even between different congregations, where there would be men who would be given the task of caring for the finances, the building, the poor, the needy, and so on. Something like deacons, they weren't called that. Well, in the 1840s, a number of Reformed Presbyterians in North America started to argue that we should have ordained deacons in our congregations. And thus erupted the deacon controversy in the RP Church. We seem to appeal to people who have strong opinions on various subjects, and we actually had competing denominational journals, one pro-deacon and one anti-deacon. And this was fought not only in the press, but also in the courts of the church. Reverend Phil Pockris, who's a pastor in Ohio, now is married to the former Judy Wilson. And her ancestors were in the church at this time and very involved in the deacon controversy. And the some members of their family were in the pro-deacon camp, and they were in the anti-deacon camp. And the Wilsons, who were pro-deacons, were associated with the seminary. The seminary as such didn't take a position. But Judy's family was so incensed that they wanted to make clear that they were not pro-deacon, so they changed the spelling of their name from double L Wilson to single L Wilson. And to this day, in the RP Church, we have double L Wilsons and single L Wilsons, depending on whether their ancestors were pro-deacon or anti-deacon. It's just hard to believe, but that's what history tells us. So anyway, finally the church accepted deacons. The pro-deacon people won. But not all congregations had deacons, because some congregations were anti-deacon. And that set us up for the next big issue about deacons. In 1888, the congregation in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, which is now defunct, elected deacons, and they elected a woman a deacon. This was without precedent in the Reformed Presbyterian Church. And so the Presbytery of Pittsburgh, McKeesport is located near Pittsburgh, told them not to ordain her until they'd seen what Synod thought. Well, Synod discussed the issue, and they said that if no men were available to serve as deacons, then a woman could be ordained. But that congregations and presbyteries should be very careful how they did that. And so McKeesport went on and ordained this lady. What is even more interesting than just the bare facts is that after they made the decision, the synod elected a two-man committee to write a justification for what they'd just done. Very un-Presbyterian. Presbyterians always study an issue before they make a decision. And we didn't in that case. And so two ministers wrote a justification. At this point, the understanding was that it was permissive. It was permitted, but it wasn't required. No congregation had to. And that's always been the position of the synod. Vast majority of congregations today have no women deacons, but some do. So the church became the first Presbyterian church in the world to permit women deacons. No church had done it before then in the Westminster tradition. The Reformed Presbyterian Church generally was a rural church until pretty recently, really until the 1950s. It was largely farmers. Yes?
So you're saying they came up with this? conclusion and then went back and found evidence.
Yes. Yes, that's right. Right. Yes. Church is not proud of that. Even those who support women deacons are not proud of that procedure. Gets cart before the horse, yeah. What happened very often is that the ministers, because they'd done an undergraduate degree and then gone to the seminary for 3 years, were not simply very intelligent, but they were very well educated compared with the people in the congregation. And as a result, ministers tended to dominate the session because they were well-spoken, they were well-educated, they were super intelligent. And ministers can take advantage of that. And I think that to some extent the quality of the eldership was lessened over time because they were kind of smothered by well-meaning, but ultimately perhaps not as wise as they should be pastors. And the eldership tended to function very much in the shadow of the ministry. I think the situation was rather better in the Southern Presbyterian Church, which had emphasized the parity between ruling elders and teaching elders, more so than certainly Reformed Presbyterians had. And then I'm pulling out some of our dirty laundry here. In 1938, a five-man committee unanimously suggested that we have women ruling elders. This created quite a stir, and the synod voted to place the recommendation on the table until the following synod. And in that succeeding year, two ministers, both of them missionaries in China, one Paul Martin's father, Philip Martin, and the other Dr. J.G. Voss, wrote a critique of the committee report that is just about as devastating certainly as it deserved, but it's just a devastating critique. And the whole idea was kind of dropped by the succeeding synod. It's never been raised again, really, in the church. What had happened is that the church, like a lot of denominations in the early 20th century, had become affected by a certain theological liberalism in which the scriptures no longer were authoritative in the same way as before, and in which people in the church began to say to themselves, what are the great issues that we need to address in our society? And of course, 1938, women had just started voting, 1920, in American society. There had been there was a great feminist movement, and even the best churches are not immune from influences from the society outside them. Don't ever think that that isn't the case. We are affected. It's not just the styles of clothes we wear and things like that, though that's sort of obvious, but the more subtle things. And God, in His great grace, really has largely spared us from continuing influence from that kind of thinking. And a lot of that was due to Dr. J.G. Voss, who after he was a missionary in China for some years, was forced out by the communists, took a pastorate in rural Kansas, and then spent about 25 years as professor of Bible at Geneva College. And Dr. Voss, who was the son of a famous Princeton Seminary theologian, Gerhardus Voss, really helped the church to return to its roots, at least that part of the church that was tempted by a more liberal theology. The church survived that. But we have to face the fact that from 1891 through 1985, the church basically declined in membership every year. And by the 1950s, ministers were, and elders and members were wondering, what can we do to reverse this? What needs to be done? And there were various responses, but I want to mention one response in particular. And that was under the influence of especially the Navigators, certain ministers started to emphasize ministry among men, a minister's discipling one-on-one men. Of course, this is the Navigators' pattern, one-on-one. And, you will certainly see that urged in Scripture. It's not the only pattern, but it is one of the patterns that's established there. What this did in fact, it led to a reversal of the decline. Church has grown virtually every year for the last 30 years. It's much bigger, even though it's very small still. Much bigger than it was 30 years ago, which is about the time we became Reformed Presbyterians in North America. But it's more than just growth. What's happened is this emphasis on training one-on-one has led to elders becoming much more forceful and forthright and influential within the church. For those of you who have some knowledge of the PCA, every PCA General Assembly is moderated in turn by a ruling elder or a teaching elder, whereas we only got our first teaching elder moderator about 15 years ago. And we've only had, I think, two in that time. We don't have that tradition, but it finally happened. We finally started to see that happening. And under that, in a sense, recapturing of the importance of the leadership of certain men in the congregation, particularly elders, the church started to look at the way we viewed elders. And in the 1970s, the church came to a decision to adopt essentially the Southern Presbyterian and PCA conception, and that is we have two offices, elder and deacon, and within the eldership there are two functions, one teaching ministers, the other ruling or elders. This was adopted pretty enthusiastically by the church, and it really represents a shift in conception and a pushing forward of elders, and ministers are less domineering compared with what they were. About 1965, the church published a volume that describes all the ministers who had served since the previous such volume had been published a generation before. And in virtually every entry for a serving pastor, it says, Reverend, something McCracken, because there are a lot of McCrackens, is in charge of, first church in so-and-so. And this was the conception, ministers were in charge, they ruled. Even though you had ruling elders, it was the ministers who were in charge. We would never use that kind of expression anymore, because there is a much greater, a higher conception of the work of the ruling elder. Now, you could argue that what happens in that case is that certain people, a certain men who should be elders, don't get chosen because they're maybe not quite so forthright, verbal. We still have lots of farmers who don't talk a lot to their corn or their hogs or whatever. Maybe aren't as verbal as some other guys. By and large, the quality of the eldership is much higher. They're much more outspoken, much more forthcoming. We had that change late 70s. Still some working out of that principle that's being done. Just what does it mean? I think we need to see more moderators be elders, but that will come. I want to talk about one other thing, and then I'll give you some time for questions. In 1986, the Synod adopted a new directory for church government. It might have been 87. I think we had to vote 2 years. And in it, for the first time, we codified the fact that that women could be deacons. Now, the Synod was very cognizant of the fact that there were some, 8 dissented from the decision, by the way, at that Synod. We all know that in the Scripture it says that a woman shouldn't speak or hold authority over a man in the church. So how do you have women deacons in office, ordained, so on? But listen to the way that the deacon is described in the Directory for Church Government. These are the opening words under the heading deacons. The diaconate is a spiritual office responsible for the ministry of mercy and stewardship of the congregation. It is neither a ruling nor a teaching office. Its exercise, like the whole life of the church, is under the oversight of the session, and its function is administrative. In other words, it is not an authoritative office. It is merely administrative. Now, that's well and good, but as some have pointed out, including yours truly, it's hardly an office if it's merely administrative. But that's where the church was. In 2001, a paper came from a Bell Center, Ohio session advocating the phasing out of women deacons. Those who were already women deacons would be grandfathered or grandmothered, and and then gradually that would cease. And 41 in Synod voted that way, which was almost 40% of those voting. And there is currently a paper from a Trinity session in Maryland, in a sense the mother church of Harrisonburg, that asks for the same thing on different grounds. You're not supposed to bring a paper on the same grounds over and over again. You have to bring new grounds. And they have. I think, established grounds that had not been used previously. And so that's at the presbytery level and may go to the synod, and then there'll be several years probably before a decision's made. And just over a week ago, president of the seminary, Jerry O'Neill, and I were talking with someone about that, and we were both of the opinion that it's the majority opinion that we should change, but that whether there's the two-thirds majority required of both in the synod and in the sessions is hard to say, since that we don't take polls. The only way we know is by taking votes in judicatories. Where does this leave us? Well, I wanted to give you all this background, give you a little bit of idea of where the RP Church has been, where it is today. Now, if we're going to organize in Harrisonburg, which we all want to see sooner or later, essentially what you're wanting to do is think about the teaching elder you want to have as your pastor. The TGB is committed now, finally, to trying to send you from time to time possible candidates. I wish I could tell you that there are just, 1,001 candidates out there who are clamoring to go anywhere, and especially to a beautiful and wonderful place like Harrisonburg, but we never have a surfeit of ministers in the RP Church, and so you're going to have to win somebody. You're going to have to win their hearts, TGB is going to work hard to help you do that. You've got to think about preferably two or more ruling elders, men who would be qualified to do that. And in the Reformed Presbyterian Church, we expect our ruling elders, like our teaching elders, to be completely or almost completely in accord with the standards of the church. For instance, you could hold to either position on women deacons. Those are both acceptable, and we're not supposed to, hold back anybody. And then you want to think about those that you would want to elect as a deacon. Now, having a deacon or deacons is not essential to an organization, but you have to have two elders. It could be a minister and a ruling elder, any minister will tell you you'd rather have two ruling elders than one, especially in a newer congregation. And what will happen is the TGB will get to the point where it will recommend to the presbytery that we think you're ready to be organized, at which time then they would, if they approve, you would meet and elect elders. If possible, we would train and meet with, as a TGB, any candidates, any men who thought they were called to the eldership, and pre-approve them. In which case, then they could be, the congregation would meet, elect them. The congregation would be established. They would be elected and installed at the same, ordained and or installed at the same meeting. And we could do deacons at the same time. It makes for a long meeting, but you have elections, and if the elders and deacons are pre-approved, once the congregation is elected, also at that same meeting, if you're ready to, you can elect a pastor. In those elections, there are two options. One is that the TGB would suggest names for one or two or three of those offices, or that we simply let you nominate from the floor. But even if we do name someone or someone's, the congregation always has the option of nominating somebody else from the floor. That's never closed. But again, if they're elders or deacons that you're electing and they haven't been pre-approved, then they would have to meet with the governing body, with the session, or the TGB, depending on which office we're talking about, and then be approved, and then there'd be a later service in which we would ordain and install. and or install officers. Well, I'm a little rushed here at the end, but I have any questions. Sorry.